From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how Detroiters are losing their homes over tiny tax debt.
She paid her house off. She paid off her mortgage. And then she was foreclosed on last year for tax debt.
The city of Detroit wants Dan Gilbert to hand over details about his renters as it seeks out people who aren't paying city taxes.
You're kind of assumed guilty until you can prove that you're innocent. Well, based on what?
A longtime Democratic pollster takes another look at the Obama-Trump voters of Macomb County.
People are very conscious of how divided we are and how much conflict there is in the country.
And the EPA and local residents clean up a PBB-contaminated Superfund site in St. Louis. Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The very first line of an eye-opening story out today in Bridge Magazine packs quite a punch, and here it is. Antoinette Coleman lost her home for less than the cost of an iPhone. $291, to be precise. This piece is a very close look at life in Wayne County, the national leader in tax foreclosure, seizing and then selling more than 150,000 properties in Detroit over the past 15 years, sometimes for a very tiny tax debt. Sarah Alvarez is founder of Outlier Media and author of this piece in Bridge Magazine. Sarah, tell us about Antoinette Coleman. How old is she and what did she do and how long did she live in this house?
She's 70 years old, and she retired from the Defense Department, where she worked in the accounting department, and she did contract compliance for them. She lived in a very neat brick bungalow on the east side of Detroit, and she lived there for about 30 years. She paid her house off. She paid off her mortgage, and then she was foreclosed on last year for tax debt. And she's now being evicted by the new owner, and she's going to go live with a family member.
How did she wind up losing her home? She'd paid it off. How'd she wind up losing it for less than the cost of an iPhone?
Well, I mean, she takes responsibility for this, but I think that it points out some complications that we might not really think about. So, you know, when you pay your mortgage, your tax payment is part of that. And so when she paid off her mortgage, she didn't realize that she needed to start making tax payments separately. And then once she realized that, she was already quite a ways behind. You know, she was already 3 years behind. And so that was a big amount of money to make up. And she's on a fixed income. So she tried to make payments. She set up a payment plan with her bank, but she set it up improperly, and she wasn't making the payments she thought. And as she says, like, I relaxed at that point. And then the home was auctioned, and she found out that it had been sold when, she says, the new owner came to the door.
Okay, so she didn't have an idea until he came to the door that her house had been sold out from under her.
She knew she was in trouble, and she knew that she needed to pay the taxes, but she thought that she had been doing that. And so when the actual auction came around, it was a surprise, and she brought in some folks to help her. The United Community Housing Coalition stepped in to try to help, but by that time, it was too late.
And I guess as you kind of tell this story, she pays the mortgage, you know, she'd been paid off the mortgage, which is a big day for homeowners, and didn't realize that taxes needed to be paid. She wasn't getting notices. There were no notices coming to the door.
Yeah, she says that she never got a notice at that address. She is now moving into her mother's old home, and she says, you know, notices were coming to that parcel, and she knew that that one was in trouble, and so she was concerned about that, but she never thought that her home that she lived in was in trouble.
So how much might Wayne County make, Sarah, from selling a home like Antoinette's after seizing it?
Well, it's kind of all over the map. So for her home, they made over $10,000. There was a home on the west side of the southwest side of Detroit that was auctioned last year where they made over $100,000 for this kind of low dollar tax foreclosure. But then in others, you know, in other cases, they're not making any money. Places that were occupied that were then sold for very little money in tax debt weren't bought at the auction. So nobody bought them, and then they get transferred to the land bank, and then they just sit there empty and not for sale and not collecting any money for the taxpayers or for the city.
So I know there are people who are going to hear us talking, and they're going to read your story in Bridge Magazine and will say, in essence, this is really, really sad, but it is on her as the homeowner to be vigilant and make sure taxes are paid. You know, counties and cities need those tax dollars, so they can't just let people skate when it comes to non-payment of taxes. So, I mean, what did you hear from advocates? What do they think Wayne County might do differently?
I think what advocates want is also what a lot of Detroiters want. I mean, the bigger problem is that this tax auction is a huge driver of displacement. It's a huge driver of redevelopment. And I think Detroiters want to understand it better, want to be more transparent, want the rules to take into account that a lot of Detroiters, you know, don't have a lot of income and the wealth that they have is in their homes. And that they want to be able to kind of navigate the tax auction and not get taken advantage of through it. Because most of the people who buy in the tax auction are not from Detroit. They're not from the city. They're in many cases not from the state, not from the country. And so I think Detroiters just want a seat at the table in terms of the redevelopment of the city. And the tax auction is just a huge driver. And they feel like they're, you know, that they can't trust it.
You do point out in your piece for Bridge, Sarah, that a spokesman for Wayne County Treasurer Eric Sabry, Mario Morrow, told you they're working to make it easier for Detroiters to pay taxes and hang on to their homes. And your figure that you cite last year, 15,319 homes were saved because people worked out payment plans. So it seems as if the county is aware and trying to respond?
I think so. I mean, I don't think... Yeah, I think they are. The question is, like, do the people who are on payment plans, are they ultimately successful in keeping their homes? We don't actually know that. That reporting hasn't been done. But of course, the treasurer's office wants to work with people and they want to be able to do their job, which is collect taxes, and they want people to be able to stay in their homes. I completely believe that that's what they want to do. But I think that this tax auction is just, like I said, just a very difficult thing to navigate. And when I was reporting this story, what surprised me was that most people believed that there must be an amount below which the county would not foreclose on you, right? Like, oh, if you only owe $20, they're not going to foreclose on you. But the county said, like, no, they don't have a lower limit because they don't want to incentivize people to not pay their taxes. So it's a hard position for them to be in, but it's also a hard position to be in if you're going to lose your house over a couple of $100.
Sarah Alvarez, her story, Foreclosed for Less Than the Cost of iPhone, That's Life in Wayne County, is at bridgemi.com. Sarah, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure, thank you.
The city of Detroit is suing Dan Gilbert's real estate company, Bedrock Management, for refusing to hand over personal information of its apartment building tenants. The city wants to find out if those tenants have paid their Detroit income taxes. Gilbert maintains he doesn't have the legal right to release tenants' personal information to any third party. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now. So, Daniel, you say the city has a right to collect what it's owed under existing law?
Well, sure. I mean, there's existing tax law. People know that going in, or at least they should know that going in. And the city has a right to collect them. I think the issue is the one that Dan Gilbert has raised. And by the way, the interesting thing here is these are two best friends essentially going at each other over this issue, is that this is a dragnet. And this essentially assumes that people aren't paying their taxes or paying the right rate and are somehow falsifying where their actual permanent address is.
But if the city has a right to collect what it's owed, why not help the city do that, particularly considering all the tens of millions of dollars in tax breaks Gilbert has gotten to develop that portfolio of downtown buildings and sites?
Well, a lot of that, that's a debatable point, I think, in terms of who got tax breaks. I mean, a lot of those buildings that he bought for cash. But I mean, if you're a resident...
But we know he did get tax breaks, even looking at the Hudson site, for example.
Well, yeah, yes, but those are more state grants and other kinds of things. But take Dan Gilbert out of it. Put somebody else in there. If you're a renter who's signed on the dotted line and given the information to your landlord, and then the government, in essentially an information dragnet, comes in and says, hey, we want all that information too. after the fact. I mean, it's not that, that when I signed on the dotted line, I said they say in the fine print that my information might be shared with governmental entities for taxation purposes. That's really the issue that people are raising here. And I think the second one that I find troublesome, and we see this in other walks of life, is that you're kind of assumed guilty until you can prove that you're innocent. Well, based on what?
So what do you see the city being able to do, knowing, as you say, in light of its past woeful collection efforts, pre-Duggan and pre-bankruptcy?
Right. So they're doing a lot better.
Yeah.
They're doing a lot better, and they deserve credit, and the mayor deserves credit for that. And I'm not suggesting at all, but I can tell you this. The fact that this is a problem means that the tax disparity between residents and non-residents is a disincentive to people, can be a disincentive to people to move into the city. The same thing with the high auto insurance rates. And we saw the mayor and a coalition in Lansing trying to get that passed, and they were not successful. And as long as that remains, I think it's going to be a disincentive for some people to move into the city of Detroit, as is an income tax that is twice what it is for non-residents.
So you make a case for the state overhauling no-fault insurance and for the city cutting its income tax rates. Wouldn't cutting income tax rates hurt revenue the city badly needs?
It could, but remember, the city also cut a lot of its property assessments to essentially increase property tax collection, and it's been successful. Property tax collection is going up, I think, as people realize, hey, these assessments are more reflective of the market. I'm more willing to pay them, because there was a lot of non-payment on property taxes in the city of Detroit as well. And one of the reasons there was non-payment, or several reasons, one is the assessments were totally out of whack with what the reality was in the marketplace. And secondly, is people weren't getting any city services for what they were paying for. The city is doing a lot better now at delivering services, and I think people feel that there's a value proposition there, or there's becoming more of a value proposition, and they're more willing to do it. Hence, property tax collections are going up. You know, Detroit is still the highest taxed locality in the state of Michigan. It's not the only town with an income tax, but I think it's got one of the highest in the state.
But as you argue against going through the courts, what should the city do?
That's a great question. I mean, I think from a policy's perspective, if you tried to equalize your tax rate or at least move in that direction, that might be a step in the right direction. The city can unilaterally do that. The city can't reform state auto insurance rates. I mean, that is something that is beyond the city itself to do.
They tried.
They've already tried, yeah. and they haven't gotten very far.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back after a short break. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. For well over 30 years now, a prominent Democratic pollster has wanted to know what makes the voters in Macomb County tick. In 1985, Stanley Greenberg, known for being part of Bill Clinton's war room during a 1992 presidential campaign, conducted a now classic study of Reagan Democrats, the white voters, mostly auto workers, who went for John Kennedy by 63% in 1960 and then Ronald Reagan by 66% in 1984. Stan Greenberg is still studying Macomb voters. Now it's the ones who twice voted for Barack Obama and then helped give Donald Trump a win. He studied them in early 2017 and then went back in March for more focus groups, trying to see what else he could learn from these Obama-Trump voters. His report for Democracy Corps is titled Macomb and America's New Political Moment. Stan Greenberg, welcome.
Thank you.
You've been studying these voters, these white working class voters in Macomb County for over three decades now. Why do they warrant such close examination?
Obviously, if you look at what happened in the 2016 election, you can see that they gave Donald Trump his margin in Michigan. The victory for me was that came out of that original research, which says respect these voters. There's reasons why they hold these views. They've actually feel betrayed by the Democrats. They don't like the Republicans very much. They don't like these NAFTA and trade deals and other things that have hurt working people and outsourcing. And but respect them. You know, they have reasons why they are holding these views. You know, what I found with Bill Clinton is that he was able to reach those voters and, ultimately carried them, in his second election. Barack Obama really spoke to them directly, and was able to win them twice. And I actually wrote a New York Times piece with a headline that I'm not going back, you know, because Oakland County gave a bigger, you know, bigger majority, you know, to Obama and the Democrats, and that this was the new world. But what I think what happened with Bernie Sanders and what happened with Trump, I think they felt not respected, not listened to. The Clinton campaign walked away from them. I mean, it really did show how vulnerable, you know, Democrats were in the sense of they didn't really build the bond very strongly.
In 1 year into the Trump presidency, what are these people saying about their support of Donald Trump?
Well, the men just seem confirmed in their view. And, you know, the quantitative data nationally confirms that. They're, you know, 2-1, you know, white working class men are voting, you know, for Trump Republicans in the offshore election. They're affirmed by the economy strong. He's a businessman who said he would straight a strong economy. They feel like they're in a civil war in their own family. And, you know, they now have the evidence that that was a good vote, the right vote. The women are much more conflicted. And they are, I think, much more up for grabs. Again, there's a civil war going on in their family too. They don't trust the millennials, but they don't want to be second guessed on whether it was the right vote.
What are they most conflicted about?
What they're most conflicted about is whether he's really delivering for, you know, working people, and they're upset about healthcare costs. Healthcare is, you know, is particularly powerful, important. It was a big part of the reason they voted it against, not because of, you know, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act itself, but because what they saw as is huge, you know, costs that they were having to deal with, face a penalty if they didn't do it. But what they didn't want was, you know, changes that were going to, you know, spike up healthcare costs, which is what's happening right now. And so they're very upset about that. They're very upset about he assured them that he was not going to touch Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And that's precisely what's, you know, happening now, that's on the block and has been on the block since they came into power. You know, it's more about the things that he's doing that make it much harder, particularly for working women.
Stan Greenberg, you also did focus groups with African-American women in Detroit and college-educated women in Southfield, largely people resisting
yep.
Trump. They don't support him. But I found it fascinating that both sides talk about, you say, a virtual civil war, using much the same language to talk about their worries.
Yep.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is like a unique moment. Both sides feel the country is divided. They don't, you know, there's lack of respect on both sides. They don't respect the vote the people are casting. You know, look, if we put Trump voters and Clinton voters in the same focus group, right now Clinton voters have become much more aggressive. At the outset, it was the Trump voters who were more self-confident. Now the Clinton voters are, and they're just as likely to, you know, to be rude, you know, to listen to what someone's saying and say, now I see the face of those ugly, you know, points of view that I'm seeing, you know, on TV or hearing on the radio. People are very conscious of how divided we are and how much conflict there is in the country that's been produced by this election.
Republicans are certainly hoping the Trump tax cut will give them something strong to run on in the fall with the midterms. What does your research say about that?
Our research is very powerful on this and how wrong-headed that is. People know, and in these groups, you know, people, you know, say the economy's strong. In a macro sense, it's getting better. They think they know there are more jobs out there. But that hasn't touched, you know, in our data. Overwhelmingly, people say prices can't keep, you know, their wages don't keep up with prices. And the thing that angers them the most is that, you know, the rise in healthcare costs, which wipes out any potential gain from a tax cut. But more importantly, they know it's a tax cut mainly for the top 1%. And they do believe those big deficit increases mean that they're going to be on the chopping block. It's going to be Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. They can't invest in education. You know, they're watching what's happened in the states when you had, you know, similar kinds of tax cuts for corporations and the rich. And they're very suspicious. The moment you give them any facts about it, it confirms, you know, what they believe.
As you write in your report, you can see Trump supporter morale dropping when they see the facts on the tax break. You also write in your report, Stan Gruber, you were particularly struck by comments you heard from people about gun violence and kids. What really jumped out at you?
Yeah, that was a change in, you know, what we've seen before. We do know that in working class families, that there's a breakdown of the family. There's, you know, more and more people that are, you know, that are unmarried. It's actually more stable with college graduates, but working class families, the families in a lot of trouble. You know, and obviously they are, you know, very conscious of kids being raised on their own or raised by a single parent. They're worried about a young man, some young boy, who's going to do something violent. And I think it's very real. They're warning their kids to be careful. Look where the exit sign is. Make sure you're watching out for this. And it was brought up, on their own at the outset, which is the first time that's ever happened to us, kind of when the family and guns, came up. And they were very explicit. Republicans ought to be doing something about it.
What do you think your research means for both parties? What should they take away? What do they need to change?
Well, look, this is a divided country. People hate this divisiveness. And so that's kind of the starting point, because there is actually a commonality, common conclusion about what's happened with the new politics that's emerged with the Republican takeover in Washington. But above all, they want the government ransacked for the top 1%, because they think it's a corrupt deal right now. I mean, that includes a lot of Trump voters. And what they worry about is that's going to threaten the future. And for, the future means investments in education. It means protecting retirement security. They're worried that a lot of bad things are going to happen very quickly, that we end up paying for in the long run.
Longtime Democratic pollster and strategist Stan Greenberg, who studied voters in Macomb County, also in Detroit and in Southfield, for his report, Macomb and America's New Political Moment. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Stan.
Thanks for having me.
In 1973, a plant owned by Valsicol Chemical in St. Louis, Michigan, made a mistake. It shipped a toxic flame retardant chemical to a livestock feed plant. That chemical was polybrominated biphenyl, or PBB. It took about a year to discover the accident. Millions of people ate contaminated beef, chicken, pork, milk, and eggs. That plant was torn down and buried in 1982. The 52-acre site is now being cleaned up through the EPA's Superfund. And the people of St. Louis are keeping a close eye on that cleanup, especially the members of the Pine River Superfund Citizen Task Force. Jane Keon is a founding member of the group and the author of Tombstone Town, Left for Dead, Marked with a Tombstone, A Toxic Town Fights Back. Jane Keon, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. That toxic town fights back. Boy, does that just jump out at me. What effect has this site had on your community, on St. Louis?
Well, it's been up and down. After the chemical plant closed and was buried and a tombstone was put on the site, the town really did fail and came close to being a ghost town. But over the years, and really kind of in conjunction with our group and the city fathers and mothers, lots of grants were procured. Businesses got more interested in coming to St. Louis. And the town has built itself back. It's really a thriving small town again.
Were there any health effects on members of the community having this plant so close?
Well, yes, but it's a very small town, and our county has just under 40,000 people. So we have tried, our group tried for many years to get a health study here. And the CDC, the NIEHF, they all said, statistically, there's too few of you for us to do an actual study. However, in 2012, we learned that Emory University down in Atlanta, Georgia, was actually studying the health effects of PBB. So we encouraged them to come up and join up with us, and they did. And we have a partnership now, and there are health studies going on to determine the effects of PBB on health, and then also for people in this immediate area, the effects of DDT, because we were exposed to a lot of that from the chemical plant.
Which leads to the point that cleaning this site up is just tremendously complicated, right? Because this plant wasn't making just one or two chemicals, and it's so huge they've had to actually divide it into Area 1 and Area 2?
Yes, and those are both small areas. Area 1 is an acre, Area 2 is 3 acres. So other parts of the plant will have other remedies applied to them to help clean it up.
Yeah, how many chemicals were they making?
Over 250 compounds that we know of.
That's a lot. So it isn't like coming in and drilling down to focus on one or two. And I know when the EPA invited you in on April 30th, some of you were invited in. What was that like for you being there?
Well, it was many things. Couldn't help but think of all the people who had worked there. Of course, I knew many of them, and some were in my family. And you couldn't help but think of all the activity that went on. It was very good activity in many regards. And then all the buildings, the towers, the tanks, all the structures, and it's all buried right underneath your feet, and no more activity there. However, now there is some activity, and it's a good sort of thing because it's cleaning up some of what was left behind that's dangerous to people and wildlife.
And what the EPA wanted to show you was this thermal rod treatment. What did you see? What are they doing?
Right. It's called in situ, which means in place, in situ thermal treatment. And what they do is they put these metal rods way down into the ground, as deep as 35 feet, and they send massive amount of electricity through the rod, and it heats up the soil. They heat it up to the boiling point, and it evaporates gases from the ground, and there's also some water that comes up, and they treat both the vapors and the water right on site there before the vapor, what's left over from the vapors, is allowed to go into air as steam. And what's left over from the water treatment is clean water, and it goes back into the Pine River. It's really complicated and sophisticated.
And how do you and other St. Louis residents feel about this thermal rod treatment? Do you feel confident, not so confident? How do you feel?
Well, our task force had a lot of questions for the couple of years leading up to this point, but we got satisfactory answers. And at this point, we are all on the same page. We just think it's great. We're happy that they're going to be doing this treatment in another part of the site, and they're also going to do it on a second Superfund site that we have that's across the river. Now, it only cleans up the really, really hot spots, because as you can imagine, it's very expensive. So the hot spots are where the contaminants are so toxic that it's best if they don't even dig them up, because that would expose them to the air, which would be dangerous for the workers and for the neighborhood people that live there.
What kind of relationship, what kind of back and forth has your task force had with the EPA over all of these years?
Well, it's a lot of years, 20, and so it has been varied. But I think it's inevitable that there will be tension between the agency and the community, because the community wants the best cleanup possible. We don't care how much it costs. Well, the EPA has to worry about how much money they spend, because there's no responsible party. In the 80s, after the PBB disaster, the state of Michigan asked Velsicol Chemical to leave the state and allowed them to do that. And so now it's only taxpayers who are paying for these cleanups, and it's costing millions.
And time-wise, how long are they saying it might take before you can consider this site, this Velsicol site in St. Louis, to be officially cleaned up?
Well, our EPA project manager is pretty optimistic. He says 10 years. But having seen how slowly things work, I'm estimating 20 years.
Jane, do you and others in St. Louis, and certainly the other members of the Pine River Superfund Task Force, do you trust this EPA team that's there now working on the site, the manager and the team?
Yes, we do. Not only the manager, the EPA project manager, but also the project manager for their main contractor. Yes, both of those project managers and their teams seem to really know what they're doing, and they aren't afraid to be creative when that's called for as well. So we are pleased with them.
So they're saying the project manager cleanup could take 10 years. You're looking, going, I don't know, I'm feeling it could take up to 20 years. So I'm wondering, Jane, how do you sustain community support and advocacy as this process goes on? I guess, I'm asking how to keep everyone's eye on the ball.
Right. That's a very good question, and it's always a puzzlement to us. For one thing, we don't know how our group has lasted this long, because we have learned from a sociology professor at Michigan State University who was studying us, that most groups that are organized around a single issue like this dissipate within 7 years. And so we don't know why we've lasted this long. And as for getting new people, we've had a number of new people join recently, and they are long-term residents that just finally decided it was time to get on board and help. None of them are young. I think our youngest member that's active is probably 50. So most of us are in our 60s and 70s. We even have a couple in their 80s. But we're always trying to get young people interested, and they are. They're interested, but most of them have other things on their mind as well. And we would love to get more of them involved, but haven't been successful at that.
Jane Keehan is a founding member of the Pine River Superfund Citizen Task Force. Her book is Tombstone Town, Left for Dead, Marked with a Tombstone, A Toxic Town Fights Back. Jane, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside.
My pleasure.
Let's take a short break here, and then we talk with the EPA about this cleanup in St. Louis. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back. We just heard from Jane Keehan of the Pine River Superfund Citizen Task Force. Let's hear now from the Environmental Protection Agency. Thomas Alcamo is the project manager for EPA Region 5. He's with us now. This plant, this Velsicol plant, closed in 1978, and it was torn down and buried in 1982. And while the EPA has spent money cleaning up surrounding areas, this recent investment of $9.7 million is the first investment made targeting the most toxic areas of the site. Why did this take so long?
Well, I think we had multiple phases we were doing. Don't forget, from 1998 to 2006, there was about $100 million sediment cleanup that was underway. And then in addition, we did get funding to replace the city of St. Louis, Michigan's drinking water supply. That's in excess of $30 million. And also we've completed a residential cleanup for about $12 million in the 9-block area that's adjacent to the site. And in addition, we had to investigate the site. You know, there wasn't a lot of investigation done. The state of Michigan did a very good investigation looking for areas of contamination on the 52-acre site. And so it's kind of been a stepwise approach as we have tried to remediate this site. And certainly funding is a big issue. We did wait a little over a year to get funding for the actual plant site itself, and that's why we're kind of so excited. Because of the fact is that we're starting the cleanup on the actual plant site, but also we will now continue to get money over the next number of years to get this thing completed.
When you think of 52 acres, and even Jane Keehan from the Pine River Superfund Citizen Task Force commented, when you get out there, you get a feeling just how immense this property is.
Well, yes, it's you know, a big site, you know, and it's also on adjacent to the Pine River, so. I mean, it's definitely a piece of property that we hope in the future when we're all done that portions of this property can be redeveloped for use, such as recreational and things like that. The city of St. Louis does have a recreational plan that they've looked at. So, I mean, we obviously do have a number of years to go before we get there, but it is a big piece of property. But at the end of the day, we are hoping that a large portion of it can be reused.
Now, the in-situ thermal treatment is slated to wrap up in the fall. Are you on track?
Yes, we are. We basically, right now, the soil temperature is about at 65 degrees centigrade. We expect to get to 100 degrees centigrade, which is 212 degrees Fahrenheit, or the boiling point of water, in about 180 days, and we started in early March. So we're right on track so far. We obviously, the proof will be once we, you know, think we're ready to be completed, we'll have to do some soil sampling to verify that we've met all the cleanup criteria, but in any case, so far we're on track.
And then once you say, okay, we've got that tick, that box is ticked, then what comes up?
We have another area that we're going to be using this technology for. It's a bigger area. It's about 3 acres in size, and that's the area that where they used to produce DDT and other chemicals. It's a location on the other side of the site adjacent to the Pine River. And so in any case, we hope to start beginning that work in the fall and maybe be able to start heating soil in that new 3-acre area by next spring.
How long do you expect this project, this Pine River project, in its entirety to go? And how do you know when you get there?
Well, there's a couple things. You have to think you have to separate between the construction phase and then the operation and maintenance phase. The groundwater pump and treat system for this remedy will operate for many years. But we will have the construction done, we're hoping, within 10 years. Of course, it really is funding dependent. It could be shorter than that or could be longer than that. For example, we have this next 3-acre area that we have to address. We also have another area where we're going to excavate 100,000 tons of contaminated soil. There's a couple other areas where we're doing some additional treatment and things. So this remedy is multi-phased, and so it will take a number of years to complete, but you know, if we do get the proper funding, I would say in less than 10 years we should be done.
And common knowledge has shown us once a Superfund site receives funding, the dollars will keep flowing. You just kind of addressed that as well. My question is, how can you rely on this trend in what is an unpredictable political climate? I mean, we look at President Trump's 2019 budget proposal, and it's got a 23% cut to the EPA's budget. That's more than $2.5 billion. Although we should note, the budget cuts supposedly don't touch Superfund money. But can you rely on that money?
Yes, I think, you know, we look at this as kind of like a mortgage. And when a site gets initially funded like this, we automatically get funding in the subsequent years. Headquarters does have a difficult job in terms of balancing all the sites across the country, but we've been getting funding and we expect to get funding in the future.
As we just heard from Jane Keon from the Citizen Task Force, she said the community trusts your work. How did you establish that trust, Tom?
Well, I think it's earned. Obviously, we've made some mistakes here and there, but we've tried to be open and honest with everybody in regards to approaches that we're taking. You know, the Superfund does have a big public participation component, which is much different than some of the other EPA programs. So we do, you know, availability sessions, we attend CAG meetings, things like that. So, you know, trust is earned, and we're trying to do our best we can to deal with this very difficult and complex site.
How would you characterize or describe the relationship and the give and take between you and your team and this community advisory group, this CAG group?
I think it's a good relationship. I do think that we certainly have our differences at times, but I think we've worked through those differences. We like to work, you know, they have some smart people on in their group, and we like to work with them. And for example, one of their members is a Michigan State professor that we're working closely with. So in any case, we try to work with them. We don't agree all the time, but I do think we try to listen to them and try to come to some kind of resolution with them. And we certainly have added additional components based on some of the information that they've provided.
It's got to be kind of an inspiring thought to look down the road those 10 years or so and think of the job being done and the property being able to be used the way the city wants to use it, as you say, recreation and just reclaiming this chunk of land.
Correct. And I think, you know, I can't look too far in the future because there's still a lot of issues we have to resolve here. This is a very complex site with a lot of different types of chemicals, and to try to deal with them. We also have another site across the river, the Velsco Burn Pit, that is waiting to get funding. So, you know, it's very satisfying that we've gotten funding to start the actual plant site, but, you know, there's still a long way to go and a lot of work to get done.
Thomas Alcamo is EPA Region 5 Project Manager. Thank you so much, Tom, for taking time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
Let's turn now to the world of video games, meeting the world of school athletics.
Welcome to Summoner's Rift. Minions have spawned. Kill. Victory!
This weekend brings the final round of a 3-month online gaming competition among 32 Michigan high schools. They're called eSports, and it's rolling out in high schools around the country. Here with us now, Andrew Blanchard, who's tournament director for eSports Michigan. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you with us. And from the Milan High School Liquid Ninjas team, we say hello to Chase Kegley. Great to have you here, Chase.
Hello. It's very nice to be here.
Now, Andrew, start off by explaining just what happens at an eSports competition.
So eSports competition like this will see the teams compete from behind their computer screens on a virtual world where they are going to be competing to defeat the enemy team and move on in the same kind of bracket style you would see in like a March Madness or the NFL playoffs, where one team plays another team a couple times, best of three competition, then they, you know, knock out and they move up. It's going to be a lot of interesting action going on for the people who know the game and love the game and appreciate the game for what it is, to watch these teams really battle back and forth and create a lot of good memories and a lot of good, hopefully good competition between them. We're going to be streaming it, so all the people are going to be, you know, in our large atrium watching the games live as they go on, as they play. And it's going to be about, you know, 160 people in a room all cheering and shouting and really, you know, getting interested in this action.
And so you've been at, this has been going on for a while. As you say, it started with the 32. Now you're winnowed down. So how many will be competing this coming weekend?
This coming weekend is going to be from the 32 down to 16.
And where are the Milan High School Liquid Ninjas, Chase?
In our group, we were placed third of four because each group was consisted of eight teams. So out of the eight teams, we played a double round robin. And we ended up being the third out of the eight, top three out of the eight teams.
What's the game everybody's playing?
League of Legends.
Tell us a little about that.
League of Legends is a 5v5 game where the goal of the game is to destroy the other person's nexus. And between the nexus is, I think, 12 towers, 13 towers. And you have to push through those to be able to get to the enemy nexus and destroy it. And each person plays their own champion, which is like the character they decide to play during the match. And throughout the games, they last about, give or take, it can last between 20 minutes to 50 minutes, depending on how hard fought the game will be.
And I'm interested in, Andrew Blanchard, what does the winning team get from the competition?
So the winning team for this year's competition is going to be awarded a large amount of scholarship money for each of the competing teams towards Lawrence Technological University. They're our main hosts. They're the ones that are really putting up a lot to help us to organize this competition. So the first team and the second place team are both going to be awarded four-year scholarships per player on the team. They're approximately just under a half ride, more or less. It's about half of what you would spend in a given semester. And that goes to both the first and the second place team.
And how many are on your team?
Currently, there are six. There's five main people, and then there's one substitute.
So who's on the Liquid Ninjas at Milan? What grades? Do you have any women playing?
Our team consists of all men, and there are three seniors and three sophomores, actually.
Now, this is Milan's first year, right, having an esports team. So I'm curious, what did it take to get the school to say, okay, we'll do this?
Actually, the school kind of came to us. They sent an email talking about how they have an interesting offer about a game, League of Legends, on their desk. And they asked whoever plays it, come down to our office. And my friend group actually has been playing this game for give or take 4 or 5 years. So when the opportunity came up, we all decided to go down to his office and see what the opportunity actually was.
Yeah, what did you think about that? So that's not the kind of communication you usually get from school officials, is it?
Completely different. I was actually extremely excited because esports has been something I've wanted to do for a couple of years. And with an opportunity coming from my high school, I thought it was actually really interesting.
And Andrew, how are you seeing the esports movement taking hold in Michigan? I mean, how are you seeing it between high schools and our colleges and universities getting on board?
Oh, so the colleges and universities have been taking huge strides, not just in Michigan, but all over the country. Back in 2015, only two colleges in the country offered esports programs, esports teams, and offered scholarships for those teams. Now we're seeing upwards of 400 colleges across the country offering these esports teams to people, freshmen, seniors. They're recruiting players from all across the country who are in the top of their games to continue to receive education. So it at the universities especially, it's become a very large aspect of what some people look for when they go to college. And at the high school level, I was pleasantly surprised when I was calling the different high schools, such as Milan, Adrian. There were a few other schools that were jumping at this opportunity. They loved the idea of it. Some of the high schools had been thinking about trying to get a esports program going at the high school, but they were never able to find a way to jump into it or, you know, kind of tweak the superintendent or the school board to allow them to do something. And it wasn't until we gave them this opportunity for this tournament, you know, they didn't need to plan anything. All they needed to do was find five kids who, like Chase here, loved the game already and were willing to, you know, put the effort into playing it. So a lot of them just really embraced this opportunity. And as an esports enthusiast myself for the last 6 or 7 years, it was really uplifting to see these schools take such an interest in this opportunity that they can give to Chase and other high schoolers.
Now, Chase, how do you answer people who might say, yeah, competition, and I understand even some schools might offer varsity letters for esports. Come on. I mean, what do you say to people who maybe have not the greatest view of video games, saying, you know, there's violence or there's too much screen time, you're not being active? What's your answer?
Well, to me, because esports is just another branch of sports. It's still a team game. You're playing with your team, your strategy, you work to get better. Just kind of like a regular sport, except it takes out less, like, let's say, physical movement, and then it focuses on, like, the more micro movements and then using your brain more to do stuff instead of just using your body, doing the same thing over and over and over again.
And Andrew, we are seeing varsity letters and even, I think you mentioned, the scholarship possibilities.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, Lauren Sack is, you know, offering scholarships just in this realm of the winners to the competition. Many more colleges, Rutgers University, Robert Morris University, U of M, MSU, you see universities all over the country offer very good quality scholarships to these esports athletes. Like Chase said, it's really just an extension of the definition of sport, such as chess or other thought-provoking strategy games that can be played at a very high level and can be found to be extremely rewarding for the people who take the time to practice and hone their skills, their craft, to really dominate the competition. And you see the high schools are taking notice in this and giving the letters out to these athletes, these esports athletes, the same way they give marching band letters, they give the bowling team letters, they give these cheerleaders letters, the people that sometimes people don't consider as sports and more like hobbies. It isn't the first time we've heard this debate kind of deal, but it's really nice to see it that the high schools are embracing it with esports.
And Chase, I know just from looking at your hoodie, you've got your letter in track and field. So you do have a letter. And then the idea of scholarships, what do you think of that?
I think it's kind of amazing about like the scholarship aspect of it, because it means colleges and people actually start recognizing esports as an actual sport. Because I know over the years, esports are growing, growing, growing. And there's even some professional esports players for the game League of Legends that have graduated from University of Michigan, such as, and I don't know if he still plays, but he's a person named, he used to be on Cloud9, which is a pro team, and his name is High.
Well, we'll have to see how Milan High School's Liquid Ninjas do in the competition this weekend. And good luck to you guys.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Chase Kegley from Milan High School, a member of the Liquid Ninjas esports team, and Andrew Blanchard, who is the tournament director for Esports Michigan, with the big final round of this competition coming up this weekend. Thanks so much to both of you for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
A reminder to tune into Stateside tomorrow as we talk with interim Michigan State University President John Engler about the big settlement with Nassar victims. Plus, State Senator Mike Shirky will talk about his effort to place work requirements on some Medicaid recipients. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.